Pina Sharma, so good to see you.
Hi. Hi, Corey. So lovely, yes, to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited. We've been wanting to have this conversation as sort of a series, part of a series of conversations that we wanted to get to for a very, very long time now. So I'm glad that we were able to carve out this time to
Me
spend
too.
together and to spend with our audience. I'm really looking forward to the discussion today.
Me too. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, just to kind of get us started, I feel like I can't really start this conversation without sort of acknowledging what's going on in the world right now. So, as most people probably know by now, just last night there was an assassination attempt on former President Trump, and this is just sending shockwaves, I think, across the world right now as we speak. And we're having this conversation sort of in the midst of all of this.
Yes,
And, we're still learning about the possible motivations of the shooter and, all the other details. There's always sort of a fog of war that comes with these, so we're still awaiting a lot of details. But we can definitely say for certain that this was just such a deplorable, cowardly, reprehensible act, un-American act in so many ways. And really, it's a clear indicator, I think, of just how fractured and fragmented and really polarized this culture has become, particularly our political culture, which to me foregrounds really just how desperately we need a new vision of wholeness in this culture, in this country, in this world, both in our personal lives as well as in our, overall sense making and our various governing institutions. And, by that I specifically do mean the particular kinds of wholeness that Ken Wilber is talking about in his most recent book, the kinds of wholeness that we discover through, the paths of waking up, growing up, cleaning up, opening up, and showing up. And there's another kind of wholeness too that I think is sort of implicitly woven through all of those, which is the kind of wholeness that we experience by learning how to manage and harmonize and integrate polarities, which really helps us create new kinds of wholeness pretty much wherever we go. And without these different kinds of paths of wholeness, my fear is that we're really left only to the painful kind of brokenness that we so often feel in our hearts and we so often see in the world around us. The world will just continue to become more polarized. Acts of violence, political violence, such as this that we saw last night, I think are likely to become more common. And it's just such a, precarious place for our country to be right now. And as luck would have it, we're actually here to talk about exactly one of these critical paths of wholeness, namely the path of growing up, which explores the idea of vertical development through these multiple stages of maturation. And when it comes to applying these stages to our overall self-organization and just to our own sense-making, I always find myself going back to something that Ken said years ago, which is the goal is to allow every stage to be itself, always, while also governing from the highest or latest stages available to us. I just think that is such a profound and clear sort of instruction in terms of how we're supposed to hold vertical development. And so today we're really going to get into the idea of vertical development, which I think is just central, obviously, to that path of growing up. And I look forward to discussing this with you today, because I think it's more clear than ever that this idea, this particular path to wholeness, is one that the world just simply can no longer live without. So I've got a list of questions that will sort of guide this conversation as we go. But before we begin, I'm just wondering if there's any introductory comments that you'd like to make here at the top.
Yeah, just in response to what you said, for me, I think the bigger question is, how do I practice this? It's really a practice, in a way. I started with learning about it as a framework, as a way to interpret emergent reality, as a lens to understand meaning making, as a self-observation lens. But it feels like now it's more of how do I practice it? So even the quote that you said of Ken, how would I know? How would I know what is my latest stage capacity? Do I have a name for it? How do I know that I am not operating from there? How do I know that I'm falling back? How do I interpret what is going on from this understanding of the stages? And I think that's critical to practicing vertical development. So I think it's taken me a while to understand how important it is for us to deeply appreciate the landscape and the constellation of each stage, so then we can bring it in service of our development. So I think that's my comments based
that's
on
great.
What you
that's,
said.
That's well said. And it sets us up because we'll be talking a little bit later in this conversation about some of those practices, some of those methods of applying vertical development, again, to ourselves and sort of to our perception of the world around us. So thank you for that. That sets us up nicely. So I think to begin, Bina, you know, you've been in this field for over 30 years now. And I think one of the things I'm really curious about, and our audience is likely curious about too, is just what got you started, right? What really initially drew you to the field of vertical development in the first place? And how has your understanding of vertical development sort of evolved over time as you have evolved over time?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question, the second one. Well, how I got started is just by being interested in learning and growing. And I recalled only recently that my mom used to use the word immature for some people a lot. So somehow I felt she inculcated in me this idea of maturity. And she would say, oh, that's immature. And then so I began to gravitate towards more mature ways of being without knowing it, without calling it that. And through my own work, which was first external, it was initially more focused on intellectual development and then got more interested in inner process. Through that work, my own vertical growth was happening, but I didn't know it was happening and I didn't know how it was happening. So I think I really came upon this first with Ken's work. I mean, just naming the stage framework and that we go through these stages, it explained my life. It explained so many things. It was mind-blowing. I mean, the whole integral framework explained my life in many ways. You know, how I started off with different lines and how then I started including other lines, and then I could recognize in myself the precise moment when I felt I moved from achiever, stage four, self-determining, to the first post-conventional stage. So when I began, all of these pennies started dropping, and it became the most interesting thing for me. And because my profession is learning and development, and I'm personally interested in it, this has become the most comprehensive reference point for me. And I think what has changed is initially it was more of a reference point, and now it is more of a practice. It's not just what are the practices for vertical development, but vertical development as a living practice. So I feel that's more how I live it in a way today. And I think it was more focused earlier. I mean, I was more focused earlier on the later stages. And I feel more and more I'm more interested in the foundational stages that have formed me. And I remember having a conversation with Dr. Keegan once, and I was surprised. I was working with a company in Brazil, and he was my consultant, and we were doing this project. And he was very clear. He said, my focus is on moving people from socialized to self-authoring. He really wasn't concerned about self-transforming. He said, this is what the world needs. And more, I feel like, because in our framework, the biggest milestone or the, you know, one of the, like Keegan focuses on socializing to self-authoring. For us, it is focusing on from self-authoring or from self-determining stage four to actually getting into early post-conventional. So I feel more and more that's my focus, and it's bringing me a lot of clarity on what are the things we can do to support people to become more and more sort of post-conventional broadly, especially because most of our clients are in the conventional world. You know, we work with organizations, we work with leaders, we work with coaches who work with leaders who are primarily at the self-authoring stage. So we are interested in that cusp. And that's, I think, another shift for me. And I also feel that initially it was harder for me to work with earlier stages. It felt, because I hadn't integrated, not that I've completely integrated that even now, but I hadn't quite befriended my own inner earlier stages, you know? And now that I'm more friendly with them, I can be more friendly with people who embody some of those things that, you know, it would help them to move from a limiting perspective to a more liberating perspective. Yeah, and I think it feels like more of a living process now. I also see the framework really as, it's like every human being instantiates the framework in a unique way. So it comes alive. And so I feel it's my responsibility to read and to sense and to appreciate how this process, you know, how it evolves, how we grow. And it's so different in different people. And it's a real privilege to get a group of people together and to have these conversations with the support of the assessment, where then it becomes very alive. It's a living process. We're seeing it show up in the moment. And the kind of learning that happens in the collective dialogue, there is no substitute for that. You can't read enough, you can't listen enough to have some of those invisible landings, you know, that happen as a result of those conversations. So I think that's a bit of how it's different today for me.
That's gorgeous. And I really resonated with a lot of what you just said, just in my own sort of story through Integral, to Integral and through Integral, right? You know, I noticed early on that when I first started getting into this work, it really brought so much clarity sort of in the rear view mirror, right? I could look back and be like, okay, I can now see when I made this transition from like an umber to an orange self-identity. And when I shifted from an orange to a green cognition, and, you know, it was so much easier to see those sort of fulcrums again in the rear view mirror, sort of retroactively. It was more difficult to sort of gauge where I was at the, you know, I'm 20 something years old. I've got all sorts of delusions of grandeur that just kind of come with being in my early 20s, a lot of developmental bypassing, spiritual bypassing and all that, which made it more difficult to sort of assess where am I now and where am I heading. But I could see those prior fulcrums. Say again?
I'm sorry. That doesn't stop, by the way.
That's right. That's right.
I had to say that. Yeah.
But, you know, there's that piece that you mentioned about, like, you know, really sort of reintegrating, reconsolidating, recontacting these prior stages that are still alive within us, right? I think that's a big point, is that a lot of people, they're so focused on, and maybe we'll get to some of this a little bit later with some of the myths and some of the challenges around development, but they're so focused on sort of reaching up and grabbing that next handhold and pulling themselves up. And, you know, you've got this beautiful metaphor, Bina, that we've talked about so much in the past, where development isn't just a sort of a ladder, right? It's more like a climbing wall that's got a number of handholds and footholds that are distributed across multiple different kinds of intelligence, multiple paths of development that we're engaged in at all times. And one of the reasons why I named this episode Ready, Steady, Grow, I mean, it's kind of cute and, you know, sort of a nice colloquial phrase to use, but each of those terms really is deeply metaphoric to me. Like, ready refers to a growth mindset that we need to bring to this work in the first place. Steady means really shoring up and making sure that our footholds that are supporting our weight in the developmental process are solid, sturdy, and strong enough to hold us up as we then reach up to that third word, grow, in order to pull us up to the next stages. And it feels like so many people are just so you know, fascinated with the idea of growth and really see it as an achievement that I need to hit in my future, that they just focus on the handholds and not much on the footholds. And I get this like cartoon image in my head of someone who makes it to the top of the wall and their upper body is just all beefed out and their legs are just like little scrawny strands of spaghetti underneath them. And that's not a very well-balanced way of growing up. Both of these are important, both sort of cognizing and reaching forward into the next stages of unfolding in our own lives, but also constantly coming back and reintegrating and realigning ourselves with these prior stages, because they're always here. And we probably spend a majority of our time at those prior stages. You know, I think that's another thing, is that people are never at a stage. They're sort of bouncing around depending on context and what they're doing, who they're talking to, et cetera. All which is to say is I really resonated with so much of what you just said.
Yeah, I like that metaphor of the upper body built out and spindly legs. I recognize myself in that, actually.
Yeah,
I do. I do. And I also want to say that vertical development is not a goal.
Right.
It's an outcome. It's an outcome of the living process. It's an outcome of how we're living, how we make sense of what's going on inside, how we make sense of what's going on outside, and the conscious choices we bring, the unconscious patterns we bring. It's, you know, in the cauldron of all of that, vertical development is happening, and we forget that the grand source, if you might call, of the development is not us, you know. It's the ultimate presence, the ultimate reality, nature moving us towards an evolution, and that it's an evolutionary process. So we tend to appropriate the forces of nature, actually, and claim that we are the ones that are doing the developing. So I love to keep that in mind, that we are participating in it to some extent, consciously, to a large extent, not in very aware ways, but the larger forces are operating. It's the force that makes your hair grow. That's the force.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And I think it's important to remember that.
Yeah. And that gets us, I think, to Keegan's point, which is, you know, really ultimately it may turn out that Integral's greatest contribution to the world isn't so much pulling people from green through that momentous leap into teal and turquoise, but rather pulling people from amber and umber, the skill-centric stage, into orange, into self-authorship, because that is where the conveyor belt of today's world is completely broken down. Right. That's what spirituality is not allowed to mature past amber. And so, you know, so it creates this ever widening gap that we see in our culture wars and in our politics and, you know, in news stories such as we saw last night. We see this seismic gap between these particular stages. And, you know, I think a big calling, something that is calling integral people forward, isn't just to sort of lay the foundations for this new emerging stage that's coming through. Yes, that's there too. There's an emergent aspect of integral that's critical here, but there's also sort of the universal donor aspect that I think Claire Graves liked to talk about in Spiral Dynamics, which is, you know, integralists can be something like chameleons. And we can sort of get ourselves into those gaps between these stages to try to kind of pull things back together again in a skillful way, and creating processes and creating new kinds of enfoldment where people can actually start finding common ground again, which is something that we haven't, I think, really had in plentiful supply in our culture for at least 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So the next question here, Bina, is, you know, we're talking a lot about vertical development, right? We're putting a directionality on development, and we're calling it vertical development.
Mm-hmm.
But we also contrast this idea of vertical development with something we might call horizontal development. Can you explain really what the differences between these two very different trajectories of growth are?
I could, and I think the integral audience is reasonably familiar with this, but I can just say very briefly that there are all kinds of learning. We're always learning as human beings. We're adapting to our environment. Sometimes we are responding in the same patterns, but sometimes we learn some things that are new. But often we can continue to learn new things, even acquire skills, acquire, you know, whole sets of capabilities without fundamentally changing some assumptions that we operate on, by which we make sense of people or the world or ourselves. So vertical development is when some of those assumptions change. It's like you come out of college and you get into your first job and you have an idea about what it is like to work and what it means to be a responsible person or what it means to be a professional. And 5 years later, you realize, oh, I had no idea in my first year. This is what it means to be in a team or to work in an environment. This is what it means to influence, to change. everything is different now, 5 years down the line. Now, that would be seen not as new skills. That's not horizontal development. That would be vertical development. And vertical development is important, but it's not the answer to everything. It's also one way of understanding growth and development, but it's a critical way. And I might say it slightly differently. Sometimes I tell my clients, you don't have to do this, but if you don't include this lens, then it's a miss. It's a real miss. It's a real miss, a missed opportunity to understanding how to support development, especially if that's what you're trying to do with whatever, you know, you're designing as development initiatives or interventions, etc. So vertical development is important, not acknowledging it. Sometimes people will, I mean, there's, maybe we can come back to that a little bit later about the critiques of vertical development.
Yeah.
And I'll just say one thing about that, that people can critique it by saying that that is just a hierarchy that is not, doesn't serve, while describing their own perspective as a better hierarchy and not seeing that distinction. So that's interesting to me. Mm. But I think it's important. Vertical development is an important, and there are many ways of describing vertical development. There are many lenses. So one way in which we truly hold it lightly is to say this is, you know, one of a thousand, one of a 10,000 ways as an infinite. You know, there are many ways of looking at it. And it's a very useful way. At least I have found it. It has a multiplier effect in my view. Mm. Knowing about it multiplies learning, and it's also psychoactive. You know, just I think the fact that I've understood about vertical development, that I continue to learn, I continue to practice it, I continue to teach it, I think accelerates my growth. I feel that.
That's great. Yeah. When I think of, I've got a couple of metaphors that I often use when I think of sort of the differences in the relationship between vertical and horizontal development, where, you know, horizontal development is almost, it's almost like in physics, like horizontal development is a gas that expands to fill whatever container you put it in, right? Mm-hmm. Vertical development is the shape of the container, right? Yeah. Vertical development is the shape of our mind, in which is oftentimes hard to see. I mean, this is why, to kind of geek out for a second, Ken has a whole zone for this, zone two, which is very difficult for an individual to see their own stages, just like it's very difficult for them to see their own shadows and unconscious drives and things like that. But what they do see is the contents of their consciousness, and the contents of your consciousness will expand to fill whatever container you put it in. And in this sense, I sometimes think of the other four paths of wholeness that Ken talks about, the waking up, the cleaning up, opening up, and showing up, as types of horizontal development or horizontal health or horizontal wellness that are universal to each of these stages. So we've got a vertical sort of trajectory here that's taking us from these different complexities of mind, but then there's the contents of mind, which can be described with these other kinds of wholeness. And that's kind of how I see it, because really horizontal development is just simply about making yourself as happy, whole, and healthy as you can possibly be from whatever stage you find yourself. No, is that, would you say that's accurate?
I would say that I would add a couple more things, and I would see them as interdependent. Like if you look at it as a polarity, horizontal and vertical, they need each other. Mm-hmm. They feed each other. And there's a lot of horizontal development that has the potential for supporting vertical development, and does. So for example, I mean, for the last 50 years in, you know, management development, leadership development has played a significant role, but there hasn't been much understanding of vertical development. There's been a lot of horizontal development. And I think a lot of vertical development has happened because of that horizontal development. So when does it happen and when does it not happen? Where there is horizontal development, that's actually getting into the complexity of the actual process of evolving. Because you can teach emotional intelligence and it can remain as a horizontal skill development. People can learn it as a technique and practice and continue to operate at the level that they're operating. And you can teach emotional intelligence and it can really support vertical development. It can it can be the foundation for further vertical development.
Yep. Yep. As would polarity management, as would cleaning up. Because guess what? No matter how much you grow through these vertical stages of development, your shadow is always going to follow you, particularly if your shadow is coming from a prior, you know, a piece of an unintegrated stage somewhere in your history. That shadow is going to follow you throughout your growth and development. And the more we can, you know, direct our energy and our attention to reintegrating that broken, splintered off piece of ourselves, then the more likely we are, the more energy we have in a certain kind of crude sense in order to reach up and pull ourselves into the following stages of development.
Absolutely.
So it's almost, yeah, I always like Ken's metaphor of like, it's almost like people are born with 100 development points. And whenever we form a shadow, we're sort of, you know, oh, there's 20 of my development points that are now sort of lodged here in this stage, and I keep growing, but I can't quite reach the next stage unless I get those 20 development credits back, and then I can, you know, again, a very crude metaphor, but I always like sort of the simplicity there and how having prior shadows, prior traumas, prior pieces of ourselves that got split off can actually prevent us from, you know, from more easily shifting into later stages of development as we live our lives.
Yeah, and in our work in vertical development, we include that integration work as part of vertical development. But I love that it's called out because there's a huge body of work around the cleaning up, and it's a huge process that needs to be called out because sometimes people at later stages of development think they've mastered it and they think they've arrived. And I think for that purpose, it's good to call out the cleaning up. But we actually include the cleaning up as part of a healthy vertical development, I should say, as part of an integrated vertical development, because there can be skewed vertical development. You can have huge capacity in some contexts and not in other contexts. We know that. Yeah.
Yep. Well, that's great because, again, that brings us right into a nice natural segue. Would have been even more natural if I didn't call it a natural segue. It's funny how that works. But, you know, let's talk about some of the challenges that we see in vertical development. So what do you most commonly see with people who are growing into, particularly these self-questioning, self-actualizing, and construct-aware stages? So some of the later stages that you've been able to track, what are some of the common challenges that people report as they're growing into those stages?
Well, I can maybe just point to one or two things in each.
Yeah,
but generally speaking, I think people, those who are familiar with vertical development and who've got themselves, quote unquote, tested and have got a scientific feedback from an assessment, I think they tend to be, I don't know if complacent is the right word, but tend to be self-congratulatory that, oh, I'm arrived. I'm there. At least I'm not in the earlier stages. And I think that's a challenge, because we have to revisit and rediscover the entire landscape of a previous stage, which is not all available to us. And new situations in life reveal new ways in which we are stuck, new dynamics, new relationships, the changing world reveals to us new ways in which our foot is nailed to the floor, you know, where we haven't exercised, where we weren't even aware that that is an embedded part of ourselves. So my invitation to individuals at the post-conventional stages is to be really open to see what is being revealed in new situations about parts of yourself that are holding back or that are hanging back that you weren't even aware of. And I think we can never fully get past stage three, which is the socialized stage, because so much of who we are is so conditioned. We are a product of culture and society. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that we might one day fully transcend that. But there are ways in which we can become more aware and be truly free. So this is one at the construct aware stage. One of the challenges is there's a lot of maybe understanding, and there's a lot of capacity to name and frame and have multiple frames for what's happening outside. But there's not an equal understanding in terms of the self system and the nature of the self and the nature of the mind. And I find that is like really not well understood, not well balanced in our understanding of the construct aware stage. It's like, at the construct aware stage, you you recognize that the person that you think you are is constructed. And then you also, over time, as you step into the next stage, you realize that then there can never be freedom of the person, because the person by definition is created, and we are socialized into that, our pattern of memories and, you know, who we think we are and how we define ourselves, what we identify ourselves with, whether it's an early stage value or at a very late stage value, we're still identified with that. And so this realization that the person can never be free, but we can be free from the person, that gap, that space is, I think, the potential of the construct aware, where you can really separate yourself from identifying with the self. And that part, I think, is not well understood. I don't hear that much in dialogue. And then the other thing is the disorientation that comes when you are really in the process of disidentifying with part of yourself that has always been you. The despair and the disorientation, I don't think that's the difficulty of that, I don't think is understood. It's not an easy place to be. And there can be a lot of suffering and a lot of internal challenge. And of course, when you have later stage capacity, you have a capacity to hold that, but that doesn't reduce the suffering in a way. Right. It means you are able, you're more capable of perhaps addressing with it. But it depends on if it's something really new that you never knew, that you're just discovering about yourself, then you have to work through it all over again.
Yeah, you know, Ken has this beautiful phrase that's become very well known in the integral audience, which is hurts more, bothers you less.
And he's
specifically talking about waking up when it comes to that, right? We have a relative response to suffering, and we have an absolute sort of equanimity in the face of suffering. But I think this also really applies within these stages, because of course, as we continue to grow from stage to stage to stage, that represents in a very real sense a deepening, right, of the empathy, of the compassion, of the pain and the suffering that we ourselves can feel on behalf of others, on behalf of the world. And that continues to deepen alongside this sort of increase of resilience and anti-fragility in the face of suffering. So there's a flappability and an unflappability that seems to sort of become more pronounced at each of these stages. And it feels like, at least just in my own kind of personal experience, as we continue to grow, we are expanding our tool set when it comes to managing those two responses, and maybe even, you know, taking those two responses in sort of a simultaneous way where we can really feel into the depths of the heartbreak and the suffering that people are going through, even people we don't necessarily like or agree with or what have you. We can still step into that perspective and feel that for ourselves, really take that in. And there is this increasing awareness of the transparency of self, where we can begin to see through some of the constructs that get so sort of fixated on these points of suffering that can really turn into hell when they become overly fixated. We begin to identify with the suffering, with the pain, with the torment. And so there's something at these later stages that seems to tone down the opacity levels a little bit. So we can at least, it's not that we are no longer feeling it, but we can see through it while we're feeling it. That feels like something as well.
I would say yes. And if there are circumstances in your life that are just, you know, forcing you to revisit earlier pain, then it's a fresh thing, you know, and you have to learn how to navigate the stages through, go right back to the first, you know, denying it, and then rejecting it, and then looking at it, and then actually then engaging with it, and then transforming it. And that's very painful, because we have an idea that, oh, we know how to do this. And I've so many personal examples, you know, of just continuing to freshly work with stuff from earlier parts of my life, actually.
Well, to get back into the challenges, so I actually have sort of, I want to add another layer here, because we're, you know, really you're speaking to some of the common challenges that we see, particularly with some of these later stages. And that is very...
May I? Because I said I'll point a couple for each stage, one for at least each of the stages you mentioned.
Oh, sure.
We talked about the construct aware at the earlier stage to construct aware, which is the, you know, the self-actualizing stage, stage five in our framework. There is an interesting commitment to cracking it, no matter how complex it is, no matter how. So the more you know, you just want to keep learning. You can hack and crack your own psychology, and then you can influence multiple systems. So there is that commitment to mastery over that. And so that's one of the challenges I find. I've, you know, done a couple of map debriefs recently where the person was just doing more and more of inner work, more is better. And to be able to see the limits of that, to be able to see that you can drop it too.
Yeah.
What are you left with? So I think that's one of the, you know, teal challenges, if mm-hmm. you know, if you can call it that. And just this becoming aware of what the mind does. So between teal and turquoise, really becoming, I'm reminded of Rumi's quote, you know, where he talks about pulling out the chair from under your mind and to watch you falling on God.
That's
gorgeous. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And then of course he says, what more fun can it be for, no, I think it was Hafiz. What more fun can there be than pulling the chair out from under your mind and watching you fall on God? So this thing about distance from self, you know, just watching, and what is the nature of the mind? This is also another way in which our work, I feel, connects to the wisdom traditions. And that's, I think that's a distinguishing part of our work, which I can come back to later. I think about the self questioning stage, I already talked about the complacency, you know, that I've arrived and I'm not like them. And there is still a them, you know, which is all the people who are narrow, and all the people who are intolerant, and there is not a recognition about my intolerance of intolerance. And that's one of the challenges at stage 4 or 5, I think, or at the early post-convention stage. So I just wanted to cover that before.
No, that's great. That's great. And the tolerance and intolerance, you know, polarity, we might say, maybe it's a broader polarity of inclusion and exclusion or something like that. But there is a very real paradox of tolerance that people just run into like a wall at that particular stage. And it's really, really difficult to sort through, because on the one hand, it's like, well, we don't want to make anything into our shadow, right? There's nothing that we should be unwilling to look at. At the same time, we don't want to invite Nazis to dinner, right? So there is a healthy exclusion that needs to be integrated with a healthy inclusion. Because guess what? There's also a pathological version of inclusion, just as there's a obviously unhealthy version of exclusion. So this becomes a really critical polarity, particularly at that stage. We could devote an entire episode to the paradox of tolerance. Yeah. And maybe we will. And so one of the things I wanted to add here, so we're talking about some of the specific challenges that people commonly face when they're hitting these particular stages of unfolding within themselves. I want to kind of step back a little bit and look a little bit more broadly. What do we see as some of the common challenges when people are just getting into the notion of vertical development itself for the very first time? You know, and this is linked to the first question I asked you, Bina, which is how has your understanding sort of grown alongside you over the years? Because I think we see something very similar when people get introduced to the ideas of vertical development or Ken Wilber's work, integral theory, and all of that, where there's almost stages of insight and stages of our capacity to metabolize and express this material. Like, I remember in my early 20s, when I was first learning integral theory, I felt like I was learning it in a fairly, how do I put this? In a sort of dense, you know, these were meaningful lines on a piece of paper. These boxes represented something. These were categories that were very important categories, because they were like the categories of all other categories. And I would relate to that, you know, basically in that way, where these are boxes on a piece of paper, you know, talking about the four quadrants here. And then as you continue to grow into this material, there's just this transition from a third person kind of model of selfhood and of development and so forth versus your first person actual lived experience of the territory itself. And I think one of the one of the challenges that I see people often experiencing when they're coming into this material for the first time is they think that having a robust sort of third-person map means that they themselves are inhabiting some of the more mature stages that are available to people. And really, I think when it comes down to it, we can see very often, hey, that's, you know, maybe a more orange enactment of this material, or a green enactment of this material, or a teal or a turquoise, for example, enactment of this material. In other words, how we cognize this stuff in the first place actually grows alongside us as we grow and develop. So it feels like there's a challenge of stuckness sometimes when it comes from taking the move from learning a third-person map to really applying it and living it from the inside out and recognizing this within yourself, again, without that sort of developmental bypassing, spiritual bypassing, keeping track of our shadows and all of that. Have you experienced that yourself in terms of people coming into this material for the first time?
Well, it depends on how they come into it. So there are several things coming to my mind. One is, mm-hmm. how different people at different stages even react to the map report or to the map assessment itself.
Yeah.
You know, if it activates a part of the pre-conventional, then they can use it as an instrument to hurt others.
Right.
And at stage three or the socialized stage or the group-centric stage, it is a threat because they don't know how they are seen. They want to save face. They want to make sure that others either don't know about it, or if they know about it, then they should be seen in a good light.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the skill-centric stage, they can be suspicious, you know, not very trusting this and wanting to know the research. They want it to be validated. Who, you know, is the authority to be trusted, or are they valid authorities? So there's still a little bit of conformist, you know, response. And it's only at stage four that there is real curiosity at the first time. There is a willingness to be objective, you know, an interest, curiosity. And the goal usually at stage four is, oh, how do I get to five and six? You know, how do I, right. I'm only here. And, you know, it's that kind of, the measurement actually is yep. overriding. And then at, you know, early post-conventional, then you're just totally fascinated by just the whole, the storytelling aspect of the map and all the different stories people tell at different levels of development. And then stage five, you know, the self-actualizing, you really begin to see, you see the whole spectrum and you because you're already there, if you've tested it there, you're truly there, you see how well it reflects, you know, how you see the world in different, you see layers, you see levels. And so it depends on how you have come to the model. So if, you know, this is how people would typically react if they get the map report. I think I've mentioned this before. We have had a lot of people from who are integrally informed, closer or more peripherally with Integral Life or the Integral Institute. When they take the map, they're usually disappointed with the result because they, you know, they feel that, oh, they thought they were later.
Right.
And then they usually feel, no, yeah. this doesn't feel like me, which is the value, actually, which is the gift of the map, which you don't get from, let's say, an instrument like the subject-object interview, which is designed to draw your highest stage possible. So when you do a one-hour interview and I'm interviewing you and doing the subject-object interview, I'm going deeper and deeper and asking you questions to begin to see where is the limit of your sense-making or the yeah. where is the limit to the breadth of your perspective. So when you get feedback, you're getting the highest possible stage that you can go to currently, and that's validating. But what the map does is it doesn't give you the highest stage capacity. It gives you how you automatically respond in so many different contexts. And so that is, it's a semi-projective process. So it gives you a more sort of real mirror in how you operate day to day, not in your innermost, most advanced self, if you will. So they're two different approaches. And I find the map is more of a, what shall I say? Sometimes it has shock value that is good, because then it tells you that this is something you're revealing about yourself that even you weren't aware of. And what I love, of course, about the map assessment that we use is looking at language and how language reflects development, how your words, your vocabulary, the structure of your sentence, the metaphors you use, what you show in terms of your poll preferences, all of those, how they reveal how you see the world. So did I depart from your question?
No, not at all. No, you're supplementing it. And what you're talking about, Bina, I think this is really critical because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's easy for us to see the contents of our mind. It's much, much harder for us to see the shape of our mind by ourselves. And it actually, and this might be another challenge here, is that you can't just read a book to figure out what stage you're at. It actually requires interaction with people like yourself, honestly. It requires assessments. It requires another perspective on your own mind to be able to really get a detailed understanding of where your development happens to be. Because there's just, you know, it's very, very difficult to see our own sort of unconscious. So it requires a willingness to be assessed, which I struggle with. That's one of my shadows. I don't want to be assessed. I don't want everyone to know what a fraud I am, especially me, you know. It's feeling into these sorts of challenges where people actually think that knowing the map becomes a substitute gratification for their own development. And then that's probably why they're really surprised when they get the results back and they're not sort of as far along, quote unquote, as they thought they were, because it's like, but look at my mental model. It's so robust and sophisticated and it accounts for all of this.
Yeah, and my capacity to comprehend the later stages feels like I'm there already. And so I remember you had started here with your question, and I was also thinking that we don't find that disappointment in conventional organizations, which is such a lovely thing. You know, people, they say, oh, I'm at 4. So then they wanted to understand more. Or I think one of our achievements is to have the map be received by conventional audiences or with healthy interest, and then see it as something that would serve their development. And that's not easy. I remember in the early days, as I was learning, and you know, a lot of new coaches were also coming in, I know of some stories where harm was caused because of the way the maps or the assessment or the model was delivered to the client. How it's taught, how it's held, how it's spoken about. You know, that that needs to be done with sensitivity, with space for the other person, and with regard, with ultimate regard for the human being bigger than the map and the framework. So,
when you're bringing the map to those sorts of people, to more, let's say, conventional people, do you present it differently? So, for example, Keith Martin Smith a couple of weeks ago had a talk where he gave his advice for sort of being a better Gnostic intermediary, as Roger Walsh would say, a better communicator of integral to a more conventional world. And one of the things he talks about was, you know, don't present this as a vertical hierarchy, right? Because people get kind of spooked by vertical hierarchies, especially vertical hierarchies where you yourself are towards the top of that hierarchy. That kind of makes people a little bit suspicious. And his suggestion was to do basically what they're doing, for example, at Stegen, which is don't teach this as a vertical developmental map, but rather almost like horizontal types. Like, here are 8 kinds of people. What kind of person are you? And then there's, you know, a little bit less hesitation when it comes to like, oh, I'm here, but I'm not competing against any. I'm not, you know, I'm not better than these ones or not as good as these ones, because it's presented in a more horizontal way. Do you have sort of a tact like that when it comes to presenting your material to non-integral audiences?
Well, we do multiple representations, and we never shy away from the vertical. So I use the ladder, I use the arc, I use concentric circles, but I do not subscribe to saying that these are types, because this is one of the fundamental distinctions between horizontal and vertical development. I mean, forever in leadership literature, it's been that here are 5 types of 5 leadership styles, or 6 ways to be a change agent, or 7 capabilities you can have. And the fundamental message has always been no one is better than the other, and that the fundamental invitation is to expand your repertoire and not be fixed into one style. But this is not a type. This is not a typology. There is a fundamental hierarchy of perspectives. It's not a hierarchy of people. It's a hierarchy of perspectives. And we never shy away from that. In fact, I feel our achievement is that people receive and appreciate it as a hierarchy. So we, with this year, we would have completed 500 leaders at McKinsey in Australia, taking the mm-hmm. map and introducing it to them. We've not got any resistance to the ladder metaphor. But we also use concentric circles. We also say these are expanded embrace. And we also use the arc a lot, because that describes the arc of the ego, which is fundamentally the core concept on which the stages that we use are, you know, based on. We don't lay it out horizontally, and we always retain, but with sensitivity, and we always do extra work in orienting people, in talking about it's not higher and lower, it's later and earlier. So there's clean language around it, there's values around it, there's how to appreciate everybody, there's inclusivity. There's a lot of caveats. I mean, that's one of the reasons why our training programs are long, because it takes us 3 days with just setting the tone and setting the context before we start teaching the stages, just getting people really expanding their view and seeing this as one among many, and then really establishing the value of this particular framework. So that's one. And the second thing is, when we are working with conventional audiences, I mean, I never do a map debrief without an orientation of what this framework is, how we use it, how it should be used, how they can use it for themselves, and how this is just for them. It's not for reporting out their level to somebody else in the organization. So we do an exhaustive orientation before we actually do a debrief, so that it's contextualized in a way that is caring and sensitive. So we've not really gotten resistance to the vertical development. So I don't like shying away from that.
That's great. No, that's very...
I feel sometimes people are uncomfortable talking, and people are worried about other people's resistance or other people's criticism. And I'm not.
That's very clarifying. No, thank you. Thank you for that. And I guess, to be fair, it would be a little bit confusing if the Vertical Development Academy presented horizontally. That would be, you know, maybe a little confusing for people. And it is an important question, because we do have a very strong sort of anti-hierarchical kind of chord being struck in our culture, where, you know, we have such a hangover, I think, from, you know, more aggressive, earlier stage representations of hierarchy that almost always do devolve into, you know, a dominating hierarchy or an abusive hierarchy. And so I think that there's a, you know, maybe a little bit of an overcorrection in a lot of ways, which Ken has talked about his entire career, right? But there is there's an allergy to hierarchy that is in many ways well-earned, because we've done terrible things to each other throughout history in the name of hierarchy. So
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm completely with you on that. Yeah.
And that actually gets us to the next question. So we're talking here about a lot of the interior challenges that people experience when they're growing into some of these stages, or when they're coming into the material for the first time. Now I want to look outwards a little bit and actually take a look at some of the, you know, the global challenges, the meta crises that we are sort of awash in right now. Things like climate change, things like social justice, technological development, artificial intelligence, political polarization, political violence, such as we saw last night. How do you think this vision of vertical development can help with some of these problems, can help sort of untangle this Gordian knot that sits at the center of the global heart right now?
Well, that's a very big question. So I might just touch on the fact that it's really an important lens to bring to bear in terms of our own reactions to when we see these, how global challenges are being addressed, or the people who are, you know, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So that's one angle. But the other angle is, it's too abstract if you have it like that large. It's a too global a question in a way. I mean, I would want to think in contexts. How are people who are coming up with solutions or trying to address across boundaries, address these, what are their perspectives and how are they working across boundaries? And how is that interacting with what the particular industry or system has embedded in its own culture, which is, you know, what is that machine that has a life of its own. I mean, we cannot deny the power of that. So you could call it a polarity. There's power and there's perspectives. So, you know, you need people in power who also have perspectives. And you have a lot of people who have perspectives, but they don't have the power. They don't have the influence. So in systems where there are individuals who have both power and perspectives, I think that system is better positioned for actually influencing change. And I mean, the solution is all the solutions, you know, which is, I think, Daniel Marktenberger's, by the way, I love his work, and I'm continuing to really build on looking at it from, you know, relating ego development to responses to the meta crisis. So that's a pet project of mine that I've been working on for a bit right now. So you have to get a little bit more specific, a little bit more contextual to really get a handle on how is a particular system or subsystem really looking at addressing these solutions. But there is no substitute to trans-contextual dialogue.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it does seem to be a question of just horsepower, right? Like when it comes to any of these meta crises, we're talking about complex adaptive systems. And things like that, things like complex adaptive systems, can actually only really be perceived, let alone solved, right? Even perceived from particular stages of development. Mm-hmm. So if you can't see the problem, if the problem is literally up here over 95% of people's heads, then chances are you're going to run smack into, you know, the wall before too long, because there simply aren't enough perspectives with power operating in the world who can actually, you know, again, even describe the problem, let alone come up with possible solutions to the problem. So it's, you know, it does seem like sort of a race in a certain sense between, you know, because the other side of that being is, I think that the problems themselves are what motivate the development into these later stages, right? Like these are the life conditions that are emerging in the first place. And I've often said that the curse of Ken Wilber was that he was born 40 years too early. He was born, you know, really before he was laying this material out before the life conditions that required something like integral consciousness actually fully came into being in the first place. Now, thank God he did, because now we have all this runway in place for when these massive problems are crashing on our head now. Now we're seeing the life conditions emerge for the first time that are in a certain kind of way going to naturally sort of squeeze the toothpaste out of the tube so that more integrally informed minds will begin emerging in the first place, because this is now the water that we're swimming in for the first time in the history of our species.
Agreed. I mean, we have so much now to rely on in terms of guiding our thinking. And a part of me is saying, you know, every system has to build its own runway. You know, this runway that we have is not, we cannot assume that it's now accessible and available to everybody, and people will then, every system will have to build its own runway depending upon the configuration of the people who are there and what perspectives they bring. So it truly is a systemic capability, you know, in each context that is going to determine, you know, and whether there are people who know about vertical development or people who are doing vertical development, if a particular system has a few people in power who have greater perspectives, then that system is further along.
Yeah, well said. You know, the last thing I'll mention in this part of the conversation is, you know, as you know, we did an interesting test about a year and a half ago when AI started really exploding on the scene. We did what Rob Smith ended up calling the Maturing test, which I thought was very clever. Everyone knows the Turing test. This is the Maturing test.
You guys are very good.
Yeah, Rob, that was clever. I like that one. And what we did is basically we had ChatGPT, I think this was 3.0 back in the day, fill out a sentence completion form, and we sent that to Suzanne Cookreuter for her to score. And it turned out that GPT was coming in like a frickin' laser beam at orange. And she describes it like that because usually when someone's responding to these things, you see some variation. You know, that's how you know it's a human being. They're kind of bouncing up and down these stages in the response. And then here's GPT, who even when it's trying to imitate the voice of a different stage. Here's my voice of turquoise, my voice of red, etc. It's still coming in like a laser beam pretty much at orange. And it was funny because when that news came out and we got those results, some people I know was like, oh, that's disappointing. I thought AI was smarter than this. I thought, you know, I thought it was going to be capable of these meta perspectival algorithms and blah, 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 blah. And my immediate reaction was like, oh my God, this is the best news we possibly could have gotten. We are creating this massive global AI system that is coming in like a laser beam at orange, at self-authoring stage of development. This is good news for exactly all the reasons we talked about, where Integral's greatest contribution will be helping people make that momentous leap really from amber into orange, or maybe from umber into orange. The fact that AI is going to help reorganize how information moves in the world in a more orange kind of way, in a more self-authoring kind of way would be the correlate to that, I think is some of the best news we could have gotten. What you don't want is something like some of the earlier, you know, Microsoft had an experiment called Tay, which they released on Twitter, and within something like 4 or 5 hours, it started, you know, praising Hitler and, you know, calling itself a Nazi because it was just repeating the patterns of that it was being fed. So it just sank into red amber really, really quickly in terms of how it was operating. And here's GPT that's just maintaining this sort of orange baseline. I thought that was really good news and a wonderful application of these stages to one of these new sort of ingredients, new elements in this ongoing set of meta crises that we're facing right now.
Yeah, and there is a small voice in me that's also cautioning that I think that's good. It can pull up the center of gravity from earlier stages to stage four, at least, and it can be used in a subversive way by people who are at earlier stages and then be used as an instrument for, you know, their purposes. So I don't think that can be avoided either.
I share all those cautions. I definitely share all those cautions. I was just looking for some good news in AI, and that felt like it to me. So let's get to the next section. We're actually talking about both practice and application. So this is a big question for me, certainly for everyone who shows up here, because when it comes to, again, these five kinds of wholeness that Ken talks about, when it comes to waking up, growing up, cleaning up, showing up, opening up, the practices seem a little bit more obvious for some ups more than other of the ups, right? Waking up is filled. I mean, all of us probably already have some form of a waking up practice. All of us hopefully are engaged in some series of cleaning up practices that we're doing regularly with ourselves and with our partners or with a therapist or a counselor or whoever. When it comes to growing up, this has always been a little bit more difficult because, you know, growing up is, well, for one, it's a longer process, right? That doesn't have these big flashes of experience, a spontaneous, you know, awakening experiences, for example, that we get with the waking up path. So what sort of advice do you have here?
Yeah, but before that, I would say that you can have those transformative experiences even in growing up if there is a particular moment when there's a perfect storm, where there's been incremental, things have been challenged, the reality is challenging you, you're moving, and then suddenly there's a conflation of internal and external movement when it can suddenly be transformative. I mean, I have seen the map do that to a surprising extent, where people come to the map after some time about thinking and deliberating and something else is going on, and then they just want to come and take it, and then that can change a lot of things. So you can have that, but it's not that's the norm, but that can happen.
Right. Even that's a good and important point. Yeah,
even with growing up. In terms of practices, again, I mean, you know me, I think, you know, working with polarities is a very important practice for growing up.
Yes.
Which is you recognizing your own, privileging certain values, certain poles, recognizing what you're leaving behind, integrating that. And in that integration, then there is a release of larger perspectives and evolutionary, you know, process happens. I truly hold that because it's my internal reality as well as it's my experience working with a lot of people. So certainly working with polarities, I think, is a growing up practice. And I think I've mentioned this before, Byron Katie's work is extraordinary at every stage, even though its earlier stages, what you get out of it may not appear to be as deep, but the gift is huge. So that's why I say the earlier the stage, the greater the gift. The later the stage, the greater the promise. So when you're doing the work and somebody who is at late post-conventional is doing the work, the impact of that and the learning that comes out of that can be huge. And because the work is training you to question every thought, at earlier stages, you're focusing more on the emotions and the reactions related to the thought. You're focusing more on situations and relationships and people. But at later stages, you're really, you know, you're bringing your attention to thought itself and to see through the illusion of a thought, which is great practice for construct-aware thinking. And I mean, that has certainly helped me. So I think Byron Katie's work is very, very important across the stages. I also think voice dialogue is a very important practice or process. And I've been doing voice dialogue now one-on-one with Sidra Stone for the last 6 years. We meet every 6 weeks.
She's like the OG of voice dialogue.
She is. And I'm lucky that she continues, you know, to work with me, and we really, I really, really love her and love her work. And it's so interesting that her work is about becoming what she calls ego aware. It is the aware ego. That's the concept of, that's what is being built through the voice dialogue process. And the voices are always in polarities. You know, they're working with this voice and then the opposite voice. I mean, they don't make such a fine point about opposite being a polarity or not. But the interesting thing is, I cannot tell you how many times I have worked with Sidra on my own family situation, my life situation, my internal struggles. I'm working with her, and I suddenly become passionate about what I'm thinking and feeling about that. And then she'll immediately stop me and say, stop. See, now the self that is showing up, the primary self that is now showing up is, and she'll give it a name, like the psychological knower. And that kind of feedback in the moment from a person who can see, there is no substitute. It's invaluable. And I suddenly realize, oh my God, how much I'm operating out of this self. Like, I know I'm the psychological knower. And so that self, that voice then becomes object. And then that helps me integrate. But then it's also working with the one that doesn't know, you know, working with the other voice and integrating that. So I think doing parts work, doing voice dialogue, I think is very, very important for later stage work. And then I would say constellation work, family constellation, I mean, would be another practice, especially for late post-conventional. But overall, it's really about reflective inquiry, you know, no matter what. It's really about observing yourself, reflecting, making sense, and then holding, you know, loving yourself and wanting to change, both of it at the same time. So the more paradoxes, the more you can work with polarities and paradox, the more I think capable you are of having a sense of wholeness, I think. So I would say number one for me would be polarities.
I think, you know, we've had just so many conversations, how much your polarity transmission has meant to me, and how much it's lit up and transformed in so many fundamental ways how I do my own integral work, how I produce our dialogues, how I try to present this stuff in a way where, you know, we've got a dialogue, and regardless if people are actually talking about polarities, there are always implicit polarities that are underlying this conversation. And for me, that work, polarities in particular, has, as you say, become a just absolutely tremendously powerful growing up practice for myself, as well as a cleaning up practice. I have been able to do just so much cleaning up by recognizing that how I am relating with a particular pole, I might only be looking at the most negative qualities. Yeah. And if I take a step back, I can find another way where that negative can still be a negative, and I can still have my aversion to the negative, but I'm able to step back and plug that into a broader view where I can say, okay, this is the only reason this is negative is because it's become so dissociated with this pole where I maybe have more natural affinity towards. And it's helped me actually get out of a lot of different comfort zones. As soon as I recognize something as a polarity, I can say, I have always been constitutionally more predisposed to this pole, and I just haven't pushed myself to really step into this pole. And now I can see I need to, and I, you know, I kind of naturally, my mind just more easily goes there in a natural, organic kind of way.
So
the polarity piece has been huge. Yeah.
Here's a question for you. If you didn't have the polarity lens to do all the work you've done in the last, what, 5, 6, 7 years on polarity, what would have been missing for you?
Well, for one, a lot of that actual cleaning up. So the polarity work has become critical, particularly to my sense making. When I try to make sense of the polarization that I see in the world, and I try to make sense of the culture wars that we're locked in, which seem completely intractable until you learn polarity thinking, right? Mm-hmm. I would have been missing this sense that there's actually a key somewhere that can begin to unlock these problems that we are faced with in the world right now. And not many people know about that key yet. So I've taken as like, okay, well, my job is to make that key as available and as knowable to as many people as I possibly can within my own sphere of influence. So I feel like if I didn't have that piece, Bina, I wouldn't have as robust and embodied an understanding of what's happening with our political reality right now, with our cultural reality right now, and with my own personal reality, with my own relationship. I just would have been so much more partial, I think, in the way I move through the world.
Recognizing the partiality.
That's right. That's exactly the problem. It's not a bad thing to be partial. Like, you can integrate a polarity. We were just talking about this the other day. You can integrate a polarity and still make a deliberately partial choice, right? Like, okay, I see the fullness of this polarity. That doesn't mean I need to both and everything in my life. In this context, I'm going with this pole. And maybe in a different context, I would go with that pole. So you can still, you know, make choices and sort of, you know, be skillful in how you're applying this to the world around you. It doesn't turn everything into a big centrist oatmeal mush, right? But it gives you more breadth. It gives you more depth. It gives you more capacity to just see as many different facets. Because again, if we're dealing with things like meta crisis, we're dealing with these massive global problems coming from these adaptive complex systems, you need to see as many facets of those systems, and you need to be able to take the perspective of people who disagree with you if you want to find any common ground solutions going forward. So that to me has been, in a lot of ways, the gift of polarities.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'll just one example on, you know, on the meta crisis and the usual complaint. Oh, we are very extractive and we're extracting from nature and we, you know, that's caused the meta crisis. And that's only one pole. It's only seeing the downside, but it's not seeing the full picture of, yes, we're using nature as a resource. And the problem is that we are only using as a resource, we're not renewing. That's the problem. The problem is not that we're using, I mean, the resources are here, they're abundant, we're using them. And we have all had enough examples of progress as a result of, you know, we're lifting whole communities of humanity as a result of doing the extraction. But if we are not renewing, then we are, you know, cutting our legs off, we are hurting ourselves. So to say that this extraction is bad and we have to only do this is the opposite view.
Yeah.
And I think when we're talking about the issues with the meta crisis, we need to see them as a set of polarities, not as a set of, you know, we need to move from extraction to renewal. We need to move from resourcing from nature and using the bounties of nature, and we need to regenerate. And so we have, of course, the whole regenerative community popping up all over the world as a reaction to this. But regenerate also includes using the resources. It's giving back and
That's
using,
right.
giving back and using. So that is a more integrated approach. I was recently listening to Nate Hagen's podcast where he talks about the, I think you might check it out, the 20 volume knobs that he talks about, where we're seeing the shifts globally, and they're all polarities.
Isn't it amazing? You know, as you're talking about the extraction let's say it's an extraction and renewable polarity, you can actually see how we relate to that particular polarity actually changes from one stage to the next based on sort of our understanding of the world and the universe that we historically have seen with each of these stages. So when we're at, let's say, the, you know, umber into the orange stage, we tend to look at the world as this wide open frontier, right? It's an open frontier. It's an open system, which means you can really take as much as you want and you're not cognizing the consequences of that because there's always more. There's an infinite amount of frontier available to you, so why not? Then we get to the green stage, which just has a different way of modeling the world and reality around us. This is no longer a great big wild open frontier. This is now a closed system. And that means extraction always has a cost. Right? And so we make those equations. Now, at green, that's probably why we tend to make extraction into, you know, we have an allergy around that, particularly because that was the primary sort of method that we inherited from the prior stage, and that's already in our shadow, right? Yeah. So we tend to overemphasize another pole. But I think then at teal and turquoise, when we begin to understand, you know, the universe as this extractable and renewable ecosystem that we're always a part of and we only ever see just a minuscule little fraction of, that changes the equation once again. So I think that's a perfect example of how these different ideas intersect and how we can manage, align, harmonize, integrate, whatever sort of word you want to use, these polarities at a certain stage, and then we kind of have to do it again at the next stage, and we might see something a little bit differently when we do, and then we take it up again at the next stage. So kind of like shadow, these polarities follow us throughout the development, and we have to find ways to reintegrate them time and time again. And in fact, when we haven't done that work, right, that's when we're carrying around presuppositions and assumptions from prior modes of meaning making that we had earlier in our life that are just sort of remain unexamined today. So our view isn't 100% caught up with where our mind is today because we just haven't had the chance to push all of this old information through this new lens, through this new filter. And I think polarity is exactly what helps us do that in a really powerful and immediate and, you know, deeply insightful way.
You know, I call myself a user of polarity thinking, you know, like a substance user. I mean, I just can't get away from it. So I could talk about polarities for 10 hours straight.
I know. But we're not here to talk about polarities, Bina. We're here to talk about vertical development. So I've got to get you back on track here. One of the reasons we wanted to have this conversation is not only because we love each other and we love talking to each other and we do this on our own time sort of anyway. It's nice to be able to do it in front of an audience. But because you actually have an offering that you're making available to the Integral community, I would love if you talked about this training program, the Veda training programs that you are bringing to our audience right now. What are these programs? What is the opportunity here really for the people who are watching right now?
Oh, thank you so much for this, for giving me the floor to talk about it. So we have a foundations program coming up. You can take it both online, either US time zone or Asia Pacific time zone. And you can also do it in person right here in California in September. It's a foundations program that's introducing you to vertical development. Many of you are familiar with vertical development at Integral Life, but what it does is it takes you into a deep dive into the contextual way, all the caveats that I talked about, the way to hold it, the way to understand it, and to really begin to swim in the living waters of adult development, understand each stage, understand the constellation of each stage. So we've described the footholds at each stage, the polarities at each stage, so that you can really walk away. Of course, you also take the map, you get your own report. You walk away with a good sense of where you are as you show up on the map, and then walk away with a way to understand yourself and a way to understand the world. I mentioned it's been psychoactive for me. I expect it to be psychoactive for most people that engage with it. So if you just want this for yourself and you want to understand it deeper, you can come and do the Foundations program. But let's say you want to take it further. You actually are in the helping professions. You're a therapist, you're a coach, and you actually want to coach people in a very titrated, tailored way based on stage development. Then we have the second level program, which is a coaching intensive, where then once you finish the foundations, then we go over the foundations again, but how to coach at each stage. Now, you don't need to deliver a map to coach at that stage. We use maps, we use real examples from people who've taken the map over so many years to see how to recognize when the stages show up, and in some ways freeing the stage understanding from the people in a way. You know, just really looking at what aspect of the stage is showing up. It's not, is this person at that stage? That's not important, but what aspect is showing up? How would you support this person? And how would you challenge this person? So I think it's a fairly intense program. It's over 4 months. Again, you could do it online, you could do it in person. And then the last level is if you wanted to debrief the map assessment, then you could do an additional training. Then you can actually come to us, get your client to take the map, get the client will take the report, and then you get to doing the debrief. But if you don't do that, you can still have your clients take the map, but we would do a debrief and then you would do the coaching with your client. We hope to have more programs. One we really am excited about is designing one for just psychotherapists using the development framework. There's not enough in the therapy world around developmental thinking, so I'd love to do that. And we want to do one for learning designers and corporations. And at some point in time, maybe for grandparents, I would love to do something for grandparents.
Grandparents. That'd be awesome. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, I'm a grandparent. I'm living it. I'm taking my grandparenthood seriously. And so I'm seeing there's so much to be explored, you know, as a grandparent. Yeah, so this invitation is for everybody in the integral world that is touching, you know, your work, Corey, and Ken's work. And of course, individuals, if you're members, you get a good discount.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you're being very generous with the discount that you're offering to Integral Life members. So you're giving them, let me see if I have this right, $350 off of the level one training, $750 off for the level two training, which also includes level one. Which is just tremendously generous of you. And I think for anyone, regardless if you're a member or not.
It's a discount on the map assessment, yes. Yeah, and you know, engaging with people who are really interested and find this stimulating is a gift. It's a gift for everybody in question. And again, there is no substitute to really exploring this together in a collective and to doing it while you have a sense of where you are, you know, doing the map and then learning about the stages. So it's a very interactive experience and you learn as much from everybody else, actually, as you would learn from, you know, myself who will be teaching. But I think every human being that shows up is showing you a part of how vertical development happens. And that's a beautiful thing.
That is beautiful. That is beautiful. Well, and it gets back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier, where it's very, very difficult for us to see these things within ourselves. We can learn the maps, we can, you know, create our mental models, but to actually apply it to ourselves often requires something exactly like these programs in order to really learn how to live into it and to see it from, again, from the first person, from the inside out, not from the outside in. So I highly encourage everyone who's watching this right now, either the live version that we're doing right now or the recording, which we'll put up on the website in, you know, the next few days. Highly encourage you guys, check out this program. You'll get so much from it. Just like Bina, I have gotten so much from you over the years.
Thanks, Corey.
I really deeply appreciate you. So thank you for spending the time.
Thank you, Corey.
With me
You're
today
amazing.
With our audience.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for this opportunity and for your support and love having you in my life.
Beautiful. Well, and we will continue these. So I've got a number of episodes. I want to do a whole episode looking at the Umber stage, which is like the best kept secret in Integral Land. Nobody knows that there's a secret stage between Amber and Orange. We'll get into that. We've got all kinds of polarity conversations that we want to get into. So there will be more to come. In the meantime, thank you everyone who joined us today. And Bina, thank you again. I love you so
much. Thank you. Thanks everyone. And looking forward to seeing everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Bye for
now. Take care, everyone.